Welcome to episode number 15 of Tech Talk Today on WCCR 94.5 LPFM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. As always, we enjoy tweets to @WCCRTechTalk during the show with your comments and ideas. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's Tech Roundup. A security vulnerability has been discovered in something in the Unix or Linux distributions known as Bash, which stands for, was it Born Again Shell? Now, shell is kind of like the command prompt for Linux machines, or Unix machines, I should say. And this is the underlying, basically Unix is the underlying structure for all Linux distributions, and that includes even Apple. Any kind of Unix distribution has this in it. I saw it on a BBC article, and said this is a deadly serious bug, potentially affecting hundreds of millions of computers, servers, and devices. The flaw has been found in a software component known as Bash, which is part of many Linux systems, as well as Apple's Mac operating system. Let's see here. The bug, dubbed Shellshock, can be used to remotely take control of almost any system using Bash, researchers said. Some experts said it was more serious than Heartbleed, which was discovered in April. Now, we're going to talk about this later in our deep dive, but while Heartbleed was vulnerable to maybe some 500,000 machines, by early estimates, some experts say that Shellshock could hit at least 500 million. So it could be pretty serious.
Yeah, and in our deep dive, I think we're going to take a little closer look to see exactly some change or some differences between Heartbleed and what they're calling Shellshock, and get a little bit deeper into that. I guess that's why we call it deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
A Network World article about DRAM use. Now, DRAM is a type of random access memory that's used in cell phones and those type of things. And it's used in Apple iPhones. And Apple's consumption of mobile DRAM will grow from 16.5% of the industry sold production volume today to 25% in 2015 as the company outfits more smartphones, tablets, and even laptops with DRAM, according to a new report. Since 2011, Apple has been the biggest consumer of NAND flash, N-A-N-D flash, according to IDC research. Its iPod and iPhone are generally considered responsible for increasing the use and lowering the overall price of NAND, making it more viable storage for medium, more storage medium for other products such as solid-state drives. Now, a solid-state drive is one where there's no moving parts in it. It's like a big flash drive, essentially. According to DRAM Exchange, a subsidiary of the Taiwan-based market research firm TrendForce, while the launch of the iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus have created a global consumer frenzy, Apple fans still anticipating the release of the next iPad Air, which is expected to have 2 gigabytes of DRAM, and the next MacBook Pro, which will be equipped with LPDDR3 DRAM for the first time. And so all these acronyms essentially are just different types of memory inside a computer. A quote from Avril Wu, the assistant vice president of DRAM Exchange, says, quote, "Since Apple is already a major player in the mobile DRAM market, PC DRAM manufacturers will switch to mobile DRAM to meet the company's demands. This has indirectly caused supply shortages in PC DRAM and server DRAM sectors." And this actually affects consumers, because when a consumer goes to try to get regular DRAM for their computer, what a normal consumer would call getting memory for my computer, sometimes it may be more difficult to find,
because
these manufacturers are trying to keep up with the demand for smaller mobile devices.
Supply and demand, as demand will increase for a market that has increasingly less of that type of memory for most PC devices, the cost will go up. So
exactly. So you're exactly right. So this is pretty good stuff to take a look at, especially if you're getting ready to purchase memory for your computer or for your servers. You want to make sure that you know, you actually can get that in a timely fashion. You know, and there's all kinds of things that can affect when you get your parts. You know, like for instance, I guess it's been 2-3 years ago when the tsunami hit over there real bad.
Hard drives.
Yeah. It was almost impossible to get one because that's where they manufacture them over there in Japan and Taiwan, and it was almost impossible to get them.
Wow. Microsoft has put its spin on Google's Chromecast with a device that lets people mirror what's on their PC, laptop, or smartphone wirelessly under their TV. They've unveiled a Chromecast-like device. The U.S. technology giant has unveiled Microsoft Wireless Display Adapter, a thumb drive-sized gizmo that plugs into HDMI and USB ports in televisions, monitors, then wirelessly connects them with tablets, computers, or smartphones running Miracast software. Now, Miracast is a widely used standard for screencasting, meaning even some non-Windows devices, such as Android phones, should work with Microsoft's new adapter. But computers running Windows versions versions prior to 8.1 will not, interestingly. With the wireless adapter, I don't have to worry about getting everyone to huddle around a device, Brandon LeBlanc of Microsoft said in a blog post. All the content I care about, along with audio, is easily shared on the big screen. The adapters are available at Microsoft's online shop for order in the U.S. at a price of $60, with a release set for October. No release plans have yet been announced for Australia. Google launched the Chromecast dongle in July last year with a price of $35. Now, Chromecast plugs into television sets and the power outlet in their wall or whatever, and allows people to essentially use smartphones or tablets to orchestrate content stream directly from the internet. In contrast, the Microsoft adapter turns your TV into a mirrored or second screen to display what is happening on your PC or device. The Miracast standard means the connection isn't reliant on an internet or network connection. A fact Microsoft is emphasizing makes it ideal for sending content from a Windows tablet to a big screen without needing Wi-Fi. I think this is pretty cool. The Chromecast was $35, which is definitely where it wins out in this in Microsoft's attempt here. But the let me bring you back up.
you need to get more nasal, by the way. Brandon LeBlanc. You guys got to come up with notes. So anyway,
Basically, you know, it's more expensive, which is, you know, bad if you're comparing it directly to Chromecast, and it's available to more devices. But you know, $35 versus $60, that's pretty clear. However, this one you don't have to plug into the wall. You just plug it into your
USB port on the TV.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's pretty cool. I mean, you can have this device that's essentially, you can't even see it. It's on the back of your TV.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like the idea of the Chromecast. I haven't used it. We talked about it several episodes ago, and you said how you had used it and your dad had used it.
Yep.
I think this would be a fun little device to get our hands on and to try it out and to see, you know, just what it does. But the idea of taking content from a mobile device and placing that up on the larger format in front of you, I mean, that's something that people have wanted to do for years, and it's just nice to see that. There are some applications out, or there are some products out here.
Yeah.
And I thought this article was interesting just because last week we talked about Microsoft coming out with the universal keyboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's interesting that Microsoft has come out with another hardware product. I'm kind of starting to see a trend here, and I don't know if that's a good trend or a bad trend, but I hope these products do well for them.
Typically, Microsoft seems to have higher quality products. I mean, obviously not like Apple quality, but they seem to be higher than most run-of-the-mill stuff out there. Every keyboard I've purchased that's Microsoft is good. The mouse that you know, any mouse you buy usually feels pretty solid. So I think, you know, the hardware typically is good. I think they're just trying to stay relevant. So,
well, we're going to talk some about Apple hardware quality here after a while. Network World article about the cloud. Now, Amazon Web Services, they run cloud. Okay. They run cloud servers, cloud storage. And Amazon Web Services will be updating a substantial number of its cloud servers, and customers are recommended to relaunch their instances in the upcoming days, according to the Amazon Web Consultants page. Amazon has not said why the reboot is happening, but Amazon Web Service watchers believe it is a patch to a security issue. The company will be updating many of its servers between Thursday the 25th, which is today at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and Tuesday the 30th between at 7:59 p.m. Eastern Time, according to Amazon partner and cloud consultancy Rightscale. Now, these reboots aren't unprecedented, but one of the scale is quite unusual. Amazon Web Services issues many behind-the-scenes updates and patches to its cloud regularly. Every so often the company requires an instance reboot or a system-wide reboot. This appears to be one of the larger reboots of its service that requires customer action since 2011. So a lot of people have servers and storage and things like that that runs out on the Amazon Web Services cloud. So if you have that and you're listening to us right now, you may want to take a look at your portal page and get an idea of when the reboot's going to take place.
It's interesting, you know, they start doing these, updates and they don't tell anybody. It could be because of, whatever bugs may be found. They just don't want to broadcast it because the media will be all over it.
Yeah, the article stated that they probably weren't going to come out, that they had been asked why they were doing this, and that more than likely they weren't going to come out with a statement about it until they finished everything on October 1st.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, and then they'll tell, okay, here's the problem we had, and here's why we did the update.
So, I don't know how long ago we talked about Windows XP being at its end of support. Well, this isn't exactly the same thing, but Windows 7 will no longer be shipped on OEM, original equipment manufacturer, machines after October 31st, 2014. Let's see here. Microsoft will no longer provide its PC partners or system builders with copies of Windows 7 Home Basic, Home Premium, and or Ultimate to pre-install on new PCs. This means that OEMs will be able to continue to sell their stock of PCs, but they won't be able to replenish that supply. So basically, the only way you can buy Windows preloaded on a computer will be with Windows 8, some version of Windows 8.1. The deadline is, of course, October 31st. It does not apply to PCs pre-installed with Windows 7 Professional, however. Microsoft officials said again this week that they still have not yet gone public with the end of sales cutoff date for PCs running Windows 7 Professional. The lack of a firm cutoff date is a good thing for business users who are still leery of Windows 8 and waiting to hear more of the Windows threshold, which makes perfect sense before committing to buying PCs with those versions of Windows pre-installed. Let's see. All the rest is basically just talking about the any downgrade rights to go from 8.1 Pro to Windows 7 and all that. But
yeah, I mean, Windows 7 is
King
on its way. Yeah, well, it's beginning to get towards its way out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, Windows XP hasn't been shipped OEM in 5 years, several years. Once a new operating system comes out and another operating system comes out, finally Microsoft says, okay, we're not putting this natively on computers anymore. And if I'm not mistaken, in order to get Windows 7 OEM, you kind of had to ask and beg and plead at this point, too. I think if you were a large consumer, like a business, you could ask and say, okay, I want Windows 7 on these natively, but I haven't seen Windows 7 out in a retail store in what year?
I remember, I think it was a situation me and you dealt with where we went to buy one, and somebody said we weren't supposed to sell this one with Windows 7. It's supposed to come out with 8.1 or whatever, 8 at the time. I thought that was interesting, but that was way a while back.
Yeah, so like, I mean,
months.
Change happens.
Yeah.
So, and hopefully Windows 9 will be a superb change from Windows 8. Hopefully. Network World article again. Most people may not be familiar with the Internet Crime Complaint Center, also known as IC3, but their ears are likely to perk when they're told it's an operation sponsored by the FBI. And it's the specter of being targeted by the FBI that makes this brazen email scam plausible. So there's an email scam going on here about the IC3. This is from an IC3 press release. Victims report that the unsolicited email sender is representative of the IC3. So what's going on here is user gets an email, and this email says it's from the IC3. The email state that a criminal report was filed on the victim's name and a social security number and legal papers are pending. Scammers impersonate an IC3 employee to increase credibility and use threats of legal action to create a sense of urgency. Victims are informed that they have 1 to 2 days from the date of the complaint to contact the scammers. Failure to respond to the email resulted in an arrest warrant issued to the victim. Some victims stated they were provided further details regarding the criminal charges to include violations of federal banking regulations, collateral check fraud, and theft deception. Other victims claimed that their address was correct, but their social security number was incorrect. Victims that requested the additional information from the scammer were instructed to obtain prepaid money cards to avoid legal action. Victims that reported this scam in multiple states. So, the real IC3... as part of the FBI, has put in a statement that they never charge fees for filing a complaint and also never threatened to bring legal hammer down on anyone who fails to respond to an email. So people are getting these fake emails from the IC3 saying, you know, hey, we're going to put you in jail. We're going to put you under the jail. We're going to put the hammer on you. And those aren't correct. And, you know, this isn't a deep dive article, but Kurt, I mean, we've talked about this before. You know, be careful about the emails that you respond to and that you, participate in, because a lot of them are just scams.
Right. I mean, you try to call a number and see if you can get a hold of them, but I've heard of scams where they use you can get an 800 number and you'll have it forward to a cell phone or whatever, and the scammer could be out and about, and suddenly they get a ring on their phone and they'll say, "Hello, this is the IC3 or whatever, whatever they have to say. And you'll say, "Oh, I had this email." It says, "Oh, let me verify your Social Security. What was it again?" Or, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's a great point. They should be able to verify your information. You should not have to give them your information first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always really fishy to me when I call somewhere. I've had people at legitimate offices do this before, not meaning anything about it. But maybe you call a doctor's office or something, and they say, you verify a piece of information, and they say, "Well, I need this, this, and this." And you say, "Well, why don't you verify something for me?" It's kind of an exchange. It almost has to be a handshake of sorts for information verification. But this stuff is, if you get an email and you don't know who it's from and you weren't expecting that email, you're better off just deleting the thing. I mean, because if the IC3 really needs to get a hold of you, they know where you live.
FBI sponsored.
The FBI knows how to get a hold of, say, the local police department, and they come knock at your door and say, "Hey, the IC3 is looking for you." If your local sheriff comes to your door and says the IC3 is looking for you, then they're probably really looking for you.
Right.
So, there's other ways to deal with that.
Justin, do not toss your iPhone with iOS 8 in the microwave. Just going to tell you.
Okay. I'll try not to.
Good. Placing your iPhone in the microwave will destroy the phone and possibly the microwave. Well, that might seem...
Possibly. Sorry. Quite possibly.
Quite possibly. While that might sound obvious to some people, others have fallen for the quote-unquote wave hoax making its way around online. The fake advertisement insists that the new iOS 8 allows users to charge their iPhones by placing them in a household microwave for a minute and a half. Microwave energy will not charge your smartphone. To the contrary, it will scorch the device and render it inoperable. I like the word scorch. If you nuke your smartphone and subsequently complain about it online, people will probably make fun of you. Anyone who's broken their iPhone within the past week or two and wants to stay within the Apple ecosystem probably has their sights set on either the new iPhone 6 or iPhone 6 Plus. As with any new iPhone release, however, hordes of people wanting to upgrade all but guarantees long waits for the devices. For its part, Apple hopes the new iPhone's larger screens, iPhone 6, measures 4.7 inches, and iPhone 6 Plus clocks in an impressive 5.5 inches, will drain away consumers who previously waited for the ultra-large phablets produced by Android manufacturers such as Samsung. But
felt like I was watching a movie trailer there for a second.
Oh, I can do it. I can speak real fast. But what is it?
Didn't your dad tell you to slow down while you were talking on the radio?
Yeah. I want to mute you, and I'm just going to read your part. All right. But so to reiterate, do not put your iPhone in the microwave. Honestly, I got to mention this one. This is similar to the hoax that was released when iOS 7 came out. People said it now, iOS 7 makes your phone waterproof and you could drop it in and still talk on it. And there were people that actually ruined their phones doing that too. So, if you see a release that looks really official, just go to Apple's website. Make sure it's from Apple's website.
Exactly.
That URL.
We just had one of our listeners text in and say, should I put my phone in the microwave or not? Ha ha. So the answer to that, Leslie, is no, you should not, unless you want your husband to buy you a new one. So the answer to that is no. Off-topic story. I had a friend of mine when I was in school, in middle school, and his sister put the, when we were kids, you get the box of fries, maybe it's still like this, but you get the small box of Orida fries out of the freezer, uh-huh. and you could put them in the oven and heat them up, but you didn't stick them in the microwave because they had all that metal foil around them. She put them in the microwave for like 15 minutes and came back in there, and the whole microwave was like engulfed in flames, almost burnt her house down.
Oh, man, actually.
Metal products plus the microwave, no matter where you read about this, don't work together.
Honestly, like, it's reflective things, too. I put a Twix bar in its the shiny Twix, packaging, and I saw sparks, and I freaked out after 2 seconds. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't start a fire.
Recode article about the iPhone 6, as we're discussing Apple and iPhones. You may or may not have heard the news this week and saw the video. It kind of went viral of a guy who took his iPhone 6 Plus and was able to put some strength behind it with his hands and bend it. And they didn't show this part in the video that I know of, but when he tried to bend it back, it broke the screen. And it actually, you could see the curve in the metal, which, it's just aluminum. But Apple said that only 9 customers have complained of a bent iPhone 6 Plus in response to reports of problems with the with the metal of the large iPhone, the iPhone 6 Plus. The company defended the new phone's design as both "quote unquote" beautiful and sturdy,
of course,
noting that its enclosure has been constructed of a special anodized aluminum that is tempered for extra strength and subjected to rigorous testing. Apple said in a statement to Recode, quote, "We chose these high-quality materials and construction very carefully for their strength and durability. We also performed rigorous tests throughout the entire development cycle, including three-point bending, pressure point cycling, torsion, and user studies." I guess it's a sit study. Put it in your pocket. Sit down, I guess. I don't know. iPhone 6 is still part of the quote. "And iPhone 6 Plus meet or exceed all of our high-quality standards to endure everyday, real-life use," end quote. Apple said it's rare for one of its smartphones to bend, and just a tiny fraction of the 10 million next-generation iPhone 6 and 6 Plus devices sold have reported an issue. The company urged consumers to contact Apple if they experience the problem. So,
all right, about the sit study. I've seen the testing devices that car manufacturers use to test doors. They quite literally have, the frame of a door and the door, and they'll just open, close with a robot, open, close, open, close, over and over. And they, every, 100,000, shuts, opens, they'll check to see how much wear is on it or whatever. I'm sure Apple has some kind of, a robot. But could you imagine? It's like the iButt. It's for testing our iPhones.
Yeah, exactly. Or but maybe they hire people.
I like to think of the robot better.
What's your job, Kurt? Oh, my job is to do a sit test with the iPhone. What do you do all day? Well, I stick the iPhone in my front pocket, and I get up and down about maybe 300 or 400 times, and then I stick the iPhone in my back pocket and I get up and down about 300 or 400 times.
Could you imagine them doing these tests? Subject has a 36-inch waist. All right, I gotta stop this one. The iOS 8 crash rate is 78% higher than iOS 7. That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, it's not good.
According to mobile application performance management company Criticism, that's kind of fun to say, Apple's latest iOS 8 release is seeing crash rates which are 78% higher than those on iOS 7. The average crash rates across all devices is 3.56%, but on breaking down the numbers further, Criticism discovered that older devices are crashing much more than the new iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus devices, with the average for the iPhone 4, 4S, 5, and 5S being 3.57%, compared to 2.63% for the iPhone 6 and 2.11% for the iPhone 6 Plus. The average iOS 7 crash rate, as seen by Criticism, is 2.0%. Crashes will be a result of both bugs in iOS 8 and buggy apps, and so over time as iOS and app updates are released, this figure should go down. It's possible, too, that older handsets are running old apps that either haven't been updated or because the user hasn't applied the update or because the app has been abandoned by the developer and won't see any further updates. And that makes sense for on older devices it to crash more. You know, that just pushes you to, you know, buy newer hardware. But
yeah. I agree with that. And I don't like their chart.
I don't know why, even though I included it.
No. I'm glad you... When we do this show, we have obviously stuff that we read off of that we found articles of. And
part of source.
Yeah, as a source. And part of the article was a chart. And, you know, it's a pretty obvious thing that the crash rates for iPhone 6 and 6S, I'm sorry, iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, not 6S, are going to be lower than those of other iPhones, because why?
It hasn't been out long enough.
There's not as many of them. If you sit here and look at the chart, on the 17th of September, the crash rate for the iPhone 6 was 0.86%, and the iPhone 6 Plus was 0.84%, and all the other iPhones, 4, 4S, 5, and 5S, were 2.85. And then if you move 1, 2, 3... 5 days later, it's 2.31% instead of 0.86% for the iPhone 6. It's 2.15% instead of 0.84%. And it's 3.34% instead of 2.85% for all others. So if you take those calculations and put them into a percentage, it would look like the 6 and 6 Plus are crashing more.
All right.
But what's actually happening is there's more of them being sold and more people turning them on.
They did the proper thing and did like per capita and were able to figure out the percentage.
Yeah, maybe they did.
Maybe. But I thought it was that the headline caught my eye because.
No, it's a great article. And I agree with you. I think that it's obvious. We've talked about this before.
They pushed.
Yeah.
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 Pushed it out.
It's obvious that the older devices, especially the 4. A lot of people were saying don't install it on your 4 and your 4S. But the older devices aren't going to handle the new software as well. I think you and I both had 3GSs when iOS 7 came out, I believe.
I did not have 3GS. I've always had the 4 style.
I had a 3GS mm-hmm. when... Not when 7 came out, but when 6 came out.
I remember you talking about the stability issues, basically.
Oh, man, it was horrible. It was horrible. And you know, it just makes sense. I mean, you know, Apple's not going to pull the Microsoft bit and make everything backward compatible for the last 100 years.
Right.
You know, they're saying, hey, you know, you need to go buy a new phone, dummy. You know, that's what they're saying. And that's... The more power that they put in their device,
the bigger they can make the operating systems and the subsequent apps on it.
You're exactly right.
Now that's an interesting thing. Is this planned obsolescence? Are they purposefully making it a little less compatible? You know, so people are like, oh man, I got to get the new iPhone. Mine's getting slow. Everything. You know, is it on purpose? You know, there's people that have said that Android basically will they'll push and push and push to not update. until you just need to get a new handset, and then they guarantee it'll work with the new, you know, ice cream sandwich, dead cat, whatever version you've got. But in the case of, you know, Apple, are they purposely making, you know, the next ones have little incompatibility issues that they just happen to not fix or whatever? You know,
sure, why not? I would think so. I mean, if I was their marketing person, I would say
sell more phones.
Yeah, sell more phones. Yeah. It makes business sense. Absolutely. I mean, you're not going to get a pushback from the consumers because they like the new phones, and you know, it's America; they have the money to go buy one. Yeah, so
gotcha.
Okay, this is going to be our last Tech Roundup article from BGR, once again about iOS. Now, you may want to pay attention to this if you're updated to the latest iOS 8. Hopefully, none of our listeners encountered this issue yesterday, but yesterday on Wednesday, Apple released a fast iOS 8.0.1 update, but it came with some unexpected surprises. iPhone 6 and 6 Plus users who installed it have quickly discovered that the devices would no longer connect to the carrier of their choice. So essentially, if they had Verizon or AT&T, they couldn't connect to the cell phone tower. And the Touch ID sensor wasn't functioning anymore at all. Since then, Apple pulled iOS 8.0.1, publishing a special support page on its website, which reveals the company is looking to release 8.0.2 in the coming days to fix the new issues. A quote from Apple says, "We have a workaround for you if you have an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus and you lost cellular service and Touch ID functionality today after updating to iOS 8.0.1. You can reinstall iOS 8 through iTunes by following the instructions at a source link they have there on their page. We are also preparing iOS 8.0.2 with a fix for the issue, and we'll be releasing it as soon as it's ready in the next few days." Now, on the same page, Apple also published a quick iOS downgrade guide that helps you learn how to downgrade from 8.0.1 to 8.0, but you do have to use your Mac or PC with iTunes to do that downgrade.
Wow.
So hopefully none of our users found 8.0.1 and updated their 6 or 6 Plus, but if you did, then there's some information out on Apple's side that would be able to help you with that.
I know a surprising number of people that use iPhones without having ever synced it to a computer.
Mm, yeah.
And so, I mean, what do they do?
I mean, yeah, they're going to lose everything. Well, they could back it up and then go back, I guess, and then all their settings would save, I would think. I mean, if you save just your settings and your apps and stuff, I would think that you could go back.
I would hope so.
I hope. But, I don't know. But that's a good point. I mean, if you have an iOS device, hook it up to a PC or a Mac.
As soon as you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah. I mean, I've told many people have asked me, "Hey, Kurt, can you fix my iPhone? I've done the update and I've lost, you know, all the stuff." Or, "I've done the update and this didn't work." And that's a very low number, but it does happen. And I say, "Well, when's the last time you backed up your phone?" And they say, "What?" He says, "When's the last time you back it up on your computer or whatever?" And says, "I've never done that." So, you know, I'm very sorry. Take it to the store, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's important to do a backup of that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, well, that completes up our Tech Roundup, and our next part of the show is going to be App of the Week. App of the Week this week is TeamViewer, teamviewer.com. And remember, these folks don't pay us to talk about their software, but it's stuff that we found useful in the past and wanted to bring it forward to you. According to their website, TeamViewer is the all-in-one software for remote support and online meetings. You can remote control any computer or Mac over the internet within seconds or use TeamViewer for online meetings. Now, they have two different types of services. You can either do remote support and remote access. So let's say that, let's say that I'm on the beach and Kurt's at home, and I call Kurt and I say, "Hey, Kurt, I don't know how to do such and such on my computer," which is a very good possibility because Kurt knows a whole lot more about this stuff than I do. And so I call Kurt and I say, "Hey, you know, I'm trying to run such and such. Kurt's really good at this Office stuff. I'm trying to do some sort of Excel feature. And how do I do this?" And Kurt says, "Well, you know, you got TeamViewer, right?" I said, "Yeah." So I give Kurt a number and he logs into TeamViewer.com and he puts that number in. and then he can remote control my computer and show me how to do what I'm having a problem with. And that's a free service that they provide. There's some ads and things that are involved, and
right.
and I think not only that, but there is you know, there are certain things you can do with the free version that you can't do for the paid version, and the free version is just for private use.
As many good things as I've heard about TeamViewer, I've never really heard anything bad about it. I've never actually used it, so.
And it's very similar to like LogMeIn. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure you probably use LogMeIn or something other than that. But LogMeIn recently went to a paid only version.
Really?
So that's when I actually swapped over to TeamViewer. And I'm sorry, TeamViewer. And my parents live in Tennessee. And so sometimes they need some help with their computer.
The parent support call.
Exactly. The parent support call. Everybody gets one of those. And so, you know, install TeamViewer once on their machine. And then when they give you a call, you can access it from your computer or from your iOS device, from your Android device, probably not from your Windows phone.
Probably
sorry,
not.
Kurt.
It's all right.
But you can, you know, give them a hand with that. And also they do online meeting and online presentations. So, you know, if you have a small business or something like that that needs the ability to do online meetings and online presentations, then you may want to check out TeamViewer.com and take a look at what they've got to offer.
TeamViewer app for Windows Phone 8 now available.
Hey, so
yeah.
If you have Windows Phone, if
I'm
you're,
relevant.
If you're one of the other free people in the world that has Windows Phone, then you can
Windows Phone 8.
Oh, Windows Phone 8.
That's it. Two people.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just Windows. You can't say Windows Phone, Kurt. It's just Windows.
Just Windows. I'm sorry.
Remember that? So, TeamViewer.com, that's TeamViewer.com, and if you need a way to remote access another computer, check that out. Pretty cool as far as that goes.
I can
so,
mute you.
Yeah, I know you can. You did that last week. So, and all the podcast listeners and radio listeners are probably like, yay, you used him finally. So, but that's
my annoying laugh.
Yeah, exactly. The biochemical laugh. That's it for our app of the week. And let's move on to Deep Dive.
All right, we are going to move into our first deep dive, and in the category of attacks, we've actually got an issue with an Akamai security researcher, Stephanie Chazelas, has discovered a devastating flaw in the Unix bash shell. And this is what I actually mentioned earlier, leaving Linux machines, OS X machines, routers, older IoT, or let's see, Internet of Things devices, and more vulnerable to attack shell shock. It has been dubbed, will allow attackers to run code on your machine after exploiting the flaw. But the true danger here lies in just how old Shellshock is. The vulnerability has apparently been lurking in the bash shell for years. Unlike Heartbleed, which only affected a specific version of OpenSSL, this bash bug has been around for a long, long time. That means that there are lots of old devices on the network vulnerable to this bug. The number of systems needing to be patched, but which won't be, is much larger than Heartbleed. The vulnerability looks pretty awful at first glance, but most systems with a bash installed will not be remotely exploitable as a result of this issue, Ellis writes. In order to exploit this flaw, an attacker would need the ability to send a malicious environment variable to a program interacting with the network, and this program would have to be implemented in bash or spawn a subcommand using bash. So that sounds pretty serious. Now, I'm not as big on Linux commands. I've dabbled in it just a little bit. How scary? How powerful is Bash? What all can you do in that?
Bash is extremely powerful. I mean, it's a command line. So, you know, when you typically use your Mac or your PC, most of the things that you do inside of the GUI or the graphical user interface are actually just running commands in the background for you. So that's what occurs in Linux, for instance, in Unix, like what we're talking about here. So when you have a Linux or an OS X machine running a Unix bash shell, what's essentially happening is when you click on things in the user interface, you're running commands in the background that you're not aware of. And that's what's actually functioning at an operating system level. So bash is extremely, extremely powerful. Most system administrators for Linux and Unix machines don't use a graphical interface. They usually typically don't even install a graphical interface. They typically just use command lines.
Yeah.
So this is very important, a very important discovery. But the good thing is, like you mentioned at the end of the article, is that it does look awful at first glance. But you got to remember that Heartbleed was a remotely accessible exploit, meaning that I could exploit Heartbleed, the Heartbleed vulnerability, from a remote computer. With this, on the other hand, you actually have to have access to the bash shell. And that either means that you need to install a program on the computer that's going to give you access to the bash shell, or you need to be physically at the console. So this isn't, in my opinion, anywhere as bad as Heartbleed was, because it's not remotely exploitable.
Gotcha. So you have to have either physical access or like SSH?
Well, yes. You have to have physical access, or you have to have access somehow or another through a terminal session to the bash command, bash shell, or to install some sort of virus on the machine that allows you to insert bash shell commands through that program.
Gotcha. Huh. Well, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Not quite as bad as Heartbleed, but I mean, the implications could be really bad. So the possibility is there, but you know, unless you have like physical access or remoting access, like directly, I'm guessing SSH is the best example I know of for Linux. Anyways, it's not as bad. So.
And, you know, the other thing about shell shock is that it affects more devices than Heartbleed did. Heartbleed affected a lot of devices, and it was such a big deal, again, because it was remotely exploitable. But with shell shock, this dates back to the beginning of bash. So, and this is something that's just now being found. So you're talking, you know, for instance, at your house, you may have, more than likely, you have a router or a cable modem, cable gateway, or some type of device at your house. Maybe you have an Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
All of those three devices that I mentioned typically run on a Unix shell. And typically they have the ability to run a bash command. Not always, but typically, you know, you can work your way through down to the bottom layers to get into a bash command of some sort if it's been installed.
Right.
So, you know, the number of devices this affects is much, much greater than the number of devices that were affected by Heartbleed, in my opinion. So that makes it worse as far as a diverse scale of problem.
I've just been looking into Linux based distributions. I was going to see how old bash is to see how long the vulnerability has been there. Looks like bash has been helping Unix command line junkies tinker with their OSs since 1989, so 25 years that this has been in place. So that's interesting. That's scary that, you know, something's been there. But I mean, that's the case. What happens whenever you have just a team of people that build it, and maybe they can't go through all the testing in place because, you know, it's out there for anybody to use. You know, most versions, I'm thinking of distributions specifically, but, you know, if I can go out and download several different versions of, like, I would dare say, like, dozens of versions right off the bat of distributions of Linux that, you know, would have this in there. So, wow.
And, you know, this is what we call a vulnerability. So, you know, the way that you fix vulnerabilities is to keep your devices up to date. So what's going to happen here is, just like with Heartbleed, these manufacturers are going to come out with firmware updates, software updates, and firmware updates, depending upon what type of device it is. And so that's why it's important, you know, even especially for your home routers and your home cable gateways and any type of network equipment that you have at home, to make sure that you are, or in your small office or in your large office, wherever you are. But a lot of our people who are listening to our podcast or listening to the radio show right now, they're working on a home network. They need to make sure that they update their router with the latest firmware and go out to their manufacturer site, make sure it's up to date, you know, and make sure they keep the latest updates on their computers, especially if you have a Mac, because it's going to affect a Mac, mm-hmm. and there's going to be updates come out for this. So, you know, just keep things up to date.
Gotcha.
Next deep dive article is about the end of life for 2003 servers. This is came from a Network World article, and despite the years of lead time, many businesses had to scramble this year when Microsoft ended its support of the incredibly popular Windows XP desktop operating system, and we've talked about that at length here on the show. Disruption caused by the end of support for Windows XP may be nothing compared with the disruption caused by the end of support for Windows Server 2003, which is slated for July 14, 2015. So we're not talking about end user PCs at this point. We're talking about a server operating system. And here's a quote. This is from David Meyer. He's the practice director with Microsoft Solutions, which is an IT service firm. He's the practice director for Microsoft Solutions, an IT services firm called Insight Enterprises. He said, quote, "When Microsoft ended support for Windows XP in April, about one quarter of U.S. businesses were still using the operating system, which caused a series of operational issues and potential security challenges. However, he says that an estimated 39% of all installed Microsoft Server operating systems are the 2003 edition."
Gee, that's crazy.
So 40% of all the Microsoft servers that are installed around the world are running 2003, which is expiring, going out of support July of next year, less than 12 months away. That's about 24 million servers, of which about 9.4 million are in the U.S. Many instances are running older versions of SQL Server and other database applications. So
this is almost rougher than the desktop because, you know, you have a client server infrastructure, I guess, basically put it, you know, you've got all these clients that get their data, input, output, everything from the servers because the server is serving this this service. I mean, that's what it's there for. And, you know, if a server goes down, that's, you know, however many clients you've got, they're all down as well. They can't do their work. So, I mean, whatever service you've got on the server, you can't just say, oh, let's upgrade the server, because you might have something built specifically for that, just like you had on your client computer, except this could be a multitude, a magnitude worse.
Nail on the head. I mean, when user X comes in and they have Windows XP installed on their machine, then it's a nuisance and an inconvenience to user X to have their software updated. And that's, I feel bad for them. I hate that for them. But, and it's a nuisance for them.
But like one person, maybe a family.
But right. Right. But when you have to update a server, that means that you're affecting all the clients who connect to that server.
Mm-hmm.
And there's downtime involved, and there's IT resources involved, and there's personnel time involved.
Security updates for whatever new software has to be installed.
And is the software compatible?
Oh, man.
See, that's what they're talking about right here. Many instances are running an older version of SQL Server. And it says here in a note, it says Microsoft's highly popular SQL Server 2005 is heading towards the end of support in 2016. So people running SQL Server 2005 on Windows Server 2003, which is very popular, you know, they're in trouble. They need to make a move, and moving a SQL Server, which is a database server, isn't an easy thing to do. So you know, they need to get on that, and so you know, it takes time. It takes time, and you know, this is a major change that's in store for IT shops as mm-hmm. they get rid of O3 server.
I mean, worst case scenario, you've got some old system, some old product or whatever that you got running on Server 2003. And worst case scenario, you know, you have to contact the vendor and say, okay, do you have this for a recent or an up-to-date version of this program for this server? And it's pretty bad if they say, oh, yeah, we have to buy a whole new instance or something like that. But even worse, let's say, what if that vendor went out of business? You know, what if, or what if they just say, no, you're going to have to migrate to our other product, you know, that does this, you know, the same thing, and you have to do a whole new installation. And that's money you have to convince the people with deep pockets, you know, hey, let's, we need this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, custom applications, applications that have been written specifically for a specific business for a specific reason. I mean, those cost lots of money.
All those tweaks that were have been made over the years.
Customizations. I mean, you know, you're going to have to redo those potentially for a new type of operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. So, but end of life for 2003 server is coming, and users, especially IT admins, need to be ready for that. And that ends it, wraps it up for our deep dive. And I think what we're going to do is move on to our tech in numbers. Well, Kurt, technology didn't do too well today. We were down a little over 2% in the technology market, and Apple today lost almost 4 points, closing out at 97.87 today. Microsoft down a point, closing out at 46.04, and Google was down almost 13 points, closing out at 575.06. And so technology market got hit pretty hard today. And we're hoping that we'll come back from that. Apple, Microsoft, Yahoo, Intel, and Google were all down today on the market, again, for a total of a 2.2% loss for the tech market today. And that is tech in numbers.
Tech in numbers. And now, time for one of my absolute favorites, the weird and wacky tech. It's the goofiest music ever. All right, now, I kind of cheated on this one when I found this particular product because it actually hasn't been released yet. It's on Kickstarter, but I figured it's cool enough or wacky enough that it's good that, you know, I'm going to say it out there. So, what we have is the Scan Toaster by Sungbae Chang. Justin, haven't you always wanted to get your news on, you know, your weather on toast? And I don't mean
that's always been my priority in life.
I mean, and I don't mean toast as in the toast notifications built into the Windows 8
apps.
No,
I'm talking about bread toast.
I'm talking about bread toast,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. That's always been a priority in my life, ever since I was a small child.
The USB-powered toaster that prints text and images onto bread or other compatible materials was one of 9 finalists out of more than 600 entries from 49 countries in last year's Electrolux Design Lab competition. I want to read this directly. I'm loving the Scan Toaster by Sungbae Chang, one of the finalists Electrolux Design Lab contest to be held. It was held on October 9th. To be held October 9th in Zurich, showcasing possible appliances of the future. With the help of hot wires that rotate within a 30-degree radius, the USB toaster prints news, weather, and snapshots onto slices of your morning toast. And obviously, this isn't, like, a GIF. It's not going to be a moving picture. You know, if you ever try to print a GIF, it's not going to move on the paper. But
maybe if your bread gets moldy enough, though.
Well, that's really slow, though. Okay. Really slow loading GIF. I got you there. What I love about it, it takes a temporary piece of data, the weather forecast, for instance, and puts it on a temporary surface, the toast, and the time you need it right before you leave for the house. It's an ambient device that blends into the behavior of the morning. somebody already said it would be better as a wireless version, though, which I'm sure could be done in, like, a version 2. But if you actually look at this, I mean, it works pretty well. I mean, if what I'm seeing isn't just, like, you know, some sort of Photoshopped image, if that's legitimate, I mean, I guess, if you put a big temperature number on there, if it's going to rain or not, you know, that's pretty cool. I like it.
I mean, my two boys, and one on the way, but my two boys would love that. I mean, you know, my oldest loves jelly sandwiches, all right? And he can't have peanut butter, but he can have a jelly sandwich. And so, you know, to put some sort of image on the toast.
Like a character?
Yeah. If I was to put Mickey Mouse on a piece of toast and put jelly over top of that, I think that would make his day. This is pretty cool. I mean, you know, a lot of times on Weird and Wacky Tech, we talk about things that are just so far out there, nobody would ever.
Useless.
Yeah, but this is weird, but it is actually cool.
I hope it's not like $200 or $300. I think the limit I would pay might be $70. Because it's pretty cool and actually could be useful. You know, you just your toast pops out in the morning and bam, you got the weather.
Yeah. And this is one of those things where I can see someone buying this for someone else more so than buying it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, grandparent buying it for a grandkid or.
I'd see the other way better, actually.
A grandkid buying it for a grandparent?
I could see that even better because who doesn't like toast? Everybody could do toast. And if I don't know how the logistics would work, if like every time you printed the toast, it would do the most recent weather, or if you had to run the program every time you wanted your toast. But that's I could see that being more handy for an older generation. No offense, to anyone out there, first.
When are we going to see toast art?
And I thought of that too. You see people put post-it notes all over things to make characters and things. I'm sure people have done toast. I've already seen toast art before.
I've seen that too. Yeah, now that you mentioned it,
this gives him like an unlimited amount of ideas.
Instead of having to have a whole bunch of bread, you can just do all your art on one piece of bread.
Well, I really hope this wins.
This is pretty cool.
I hope this catches on.
Yeah, we're cheering for these guys. So hurrah to them. When's that going to be? That's on October
9th. That's okay. For the finalists. They're one of the finalists for the Electrolux Design Lab contest.
Awesome.
Which is, that's the first I've ever heard of that. And I click on the link. It says page not found. So,
well, hopefully they'll win that, and that would be great. That I saw the pictures of it, and that looks pretty cool. So I guess it ends up our goofy tech, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it's getting to the top of the hour, so we definitely thank you for listening to today's show, episode 15 of Tech Talk Today. Don't forget you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/WCCR Tech Talk and on Twitter at WCCR Tech Talk as well. Now, you can also listen to the podcast of today's show. Maybe you're driving down the road and you only caught part of our show and you say, well, that sounds interesting. Do a search for Tech Talk Today on iTunes or visit our Facebook page. You can listen to today's podcast and all of our previous episodes as well. And so my name again is Justin Hensley,
and I'm Kurt Lawson. We thank you very much for listening. We are the last group in this Thursday's lineup, but tuning in next Thursday when we come back.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.